We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we profile Chatterbox Audio Theater, a Memphis-based group of actors that has moved the thrill of stage plays to the internet. We hear the story of a purple stuffed rabbit named Grape Jelly, have an interview with a historian who has created a blog focusing on newspaper personal ads of the 19th century, and we learn the strange history of the marathon run at the 1904 Olympic Games in St. Louis. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The Academy Awards are tomorrow night, and one of the movies up for Best Picture is the sci-fi epic Avatar. The term the movie is based on, Avatar, is actually a very old concept, a concept that is becoming more realized in our virtual lives. New media lets everyone construct virtual identities. As independent producer Eric Malinsky explores, we shouldn't be too afraid of surrendering to technology. Our experiences online might be as real as anything.
Avatar is a very old word. It goes back to Hindu theology, when a god takes a human body, or an avatar, to walk on the earth. But avatars, as we know them, didn't start to the early 1980s, when a scientist named Chip Morningstar wanted to help sick kids in a hospital.
And so they built this idea of the avatar, which these kids would have a little visual representation, and they would log into a little local network.
Mark Stephen Meadows is a computer scientist and the author of the book, I, Avatar.
What that meant was that these kids that were normally locked up in little bedrooms in the hospital that couldn't spend time with other kids had the ability suddenly to become social and to be a little bit more of a normal kid in a way that their bodies weren't allowing them to do.
It sounds like the new James Cameron film Avatar, where a crippled soldier gets to move again through a second body. Cameron's film is the biggest blockbuster to deal with this idea in 10 years. Think all the way back to 1999. The most talked about movie was The Matrix by the Wachowski brothers.
Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Is it really so hard to believe?
In The Matrix, Keanu Reeves' character discovers that the world around him is just a computer simulation. His real body is lying in a tub of goo somewhere.
Boy, it really begins and ends with The Matrix.
Chris Baker is an editor at Wired Magazine. He says all these movies are exploring the same idea. What happens when we separate the mind from the body?
Yeah, that's something even more fundamental. It's something that goes all the way back to, you know, Descartes and the idea of, are we just a brain in a vat? Something we all fundamentally wonder about, you know, can I trust the reality of the world around me?
Movies that flopped, like Surrogates, Gamer, Lawnmower Man, or Johnny Mnemonic, came down on one side or the other. Avatars are a dangerous idea. Don't separate the mind from the body. Or they're liberating. The Matrix is more ambivalent. Your real body may be in some scary place, but if you master the illusion, you can stop bullets with your fingertips, which is awesome. Mark Stephen Meadows.
I don't think that it's as distinct, this mind-body separation, as we might think, because ultimately your brain's just this, you know, piece of meat that's stuck inside of a dark box, and there's little electrical signals that are going in and out through that dark box, namely your skull, and that's what interfaces with the outside world.
In other words, we trust our brains to mediate the world around us.
And so if I'm running around or flying around or sexing around in a virtual world, my brain still ultimately reads that as real. Media is real. It ultimately says that you are living this experience that you're viewing.
It sounds like science fiction, but that's normal for Felicia Day. She's an actress that writes and stars in a web series called The Guild. It's about a group of people that live vicariously through the game World of Warcraft.
They always say, write what you know, and I really felt like there was a lot of material to draw upon.
Shot on no budget, The Guild is funny and surprisingly poignant, especially when the characters try to be friends in the real world.
My guild, my real-life guild, did meet in real life, and that was sort of a spoof that I used in episode 5 of season 1, where the group gets together and there's just a really awkward silence until they start talking about the game.
This is Zabu, real name...
Sijan Balakrishnan Goldberg.
And I'm Clara, real name Clara.
You use your real name for your avatar.
Yeah, well, I tried an alias on another game, but my kid picked it up and started calling me Mominatrix. My husband got pissed.
Well, it's great to finally meet everyone. After spending 6 hours a day together, we can finally put a face to a voice. Talk about real life for a change.
Felicia Day considers herself a booster for Avatar games, but she wants to keep at least one foot in the real world.
I have gotten to the point where sometimes I was too online and lost touch with the people who are in my life, really. And at the end of the day, I have to think, who's going to pick me up at the airport if I need a ride? And it might not be that guy who I play with in New Jersey.
Some of you are thinking, so? I don't play computer games. I would never have an avatar. Chris Baker says, think again. Have you ever had an email relationship with someone? Are you on Facebook? Well, that picture of you and the personality you craft around it, that's your avatar.
People who would never be caught dead playing a video game are spending a lot of time tweaking the way they project themselves into an online world in the same way that someone who fine-tunes the look of their chainmail in World of Warcraft would.
Which comes back to the question, is it bad to separate the mind from the body? Well, I hope not, because we're all doing it. As we navigate through this new social landscape, it's going to be up to each of us to decide what's real.
That was independent producer Eric Malinsky. This is Sidetrack. You can get a real rush from an unexpected find. Some people get hooked on that feeling and look in unexpected places to keep it going. Independent producer Mwende Hasey wants to introduce you to a man who finds his thrills at storage unit auctions.
Americans are addicted to junk. Storage units are where they hide it. Cecil Williams lives in California's Central Valley. It seems like every small town there has its own storage unit place. Or three. Cecil sees opportunity where most of us just see anonymous sheds.
I found pretty much everything from Bibles, marijuana, pipes and bongs, all the way up to gold rings and necklaces.
Each unit holds someone's stuff. These things were important enough that they were willing to pay to store them. That is, until something goes wrong and for some reason they stop paying their bill. That's where Cecil comes in. Storage facility owners auction off the units when the bills aren't paid. They advertise in the paper or online, and then anyone can participate as long as they can pay for and then haul away what they win.
$30.
And Cecil wins a lot.
It's like I look at it like a profitable hobby. I have fun doing it because every time you get a box, and this gets on my wife's nerve that I do this, and my dog, when I open a box and I find something, I'm like, ooh, look at this, ooh, look at this, you know? And they're like, okay, you know, you get too excited. But it, to me, I don't know, it's like when you open, it's like a treasure hunt, because you never know what you're going to get.
In Cecil's garage, dusty plastic containers are packed to the ceiling with God knows what. All stuff he won at storage unit auctions. I'm careful not to rub up against a swaying tower of boxes. And then I trip over an old floor buffer. Cecil thinks it belonged to a janitor. Like most of the things he wins, Cecil's planning to sell it. He thinks it'll go for about $1,300.
It's weird how something ends up where it ends up. And I'm thinking, and I start looking at my stuff, like the coins I collect and like that. And I'm like, I wonder if one of these days somebody's going to be opening this, like, ooh, what did I find?
Yeah. Cecil tells me storage auctions are a lot like gambling. It can get really addictive. He laughs as he shows me the hole he cut in his fence so he could fit larger stuff, like old office furniture, into his backyard.
Found a whole doll collection of the collector Barbies in the boxes. Two sets of nice golf clubs, his and hers, I think it was. So it must have been husband and wife. A whole bunch of old collectible baseball cards. One of them in a plastic case was a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. I made over $400 on the dolls.
$400 worth of Barbies stored away in a dark storage unit? There's probably a story there. Maybe it was a piece of her childhood she just couldn't give up. Maybe the couple stopped paying their storage unit bills when they got a divorce. Who knows? Usually it's just anonymous junk. It's valuable to someone, but hard to understand without knowing them.
Then I found some personal pictures, and then that's when it struck me. I'm like, this is a person. You know, this is people. And then it makes you feel sad.
But not sad enough to give up his profitable hobby.
The way I look at it is, if I don't buy it, somebody's going to get it, you know, buy the stuff. But if the stuff is already out there, going to go anyways, no matter what, then of course, you know, might as well grab it.
A few years back, Cecil had a yard sale to get rid of some stuff from an abandoned unit. It had been filled mostly with women's clothes and nothing else too remarkable. There was this Letterman's jacket. He hung it up on the lip of his garage door. One customer made a beeline straight to it.
These are my sister's. She died. And then that's when she told us about what happened. Her sister was off, getting off work late at work. And she got in a car accident. And she said they didn't even know about the storage unit being sold till it was too late. And she even reached in the pocket and she pulled out a medal with the lady's name and all that. So, I mean, you know, she knew exactly what she was talking about. She says she doesn't usually go to yard sales, and she says she saw her signs, and for some reason she drove here. I don't believe in all that kind of stuff, but it was just weird how it happened, because I was sitting there, and I watched her get out, and she walked straight up to that stuff.
This experience brought a pile of old clothes to life. I like the story because it was a double unexpected find for Cecil. He found a unit with enough good stuff to have a profitable yard sale, and he helped the woman's family get a little more closure. There's another unit Cecil loves to talk about, and it was his most profitable find. He's like a kid on Christmas morning showing me the loot he found in this unit. Okay, so who would you guess owns the stuff he found? Limited edition signed footballs, a bunch of copies of a book called I Want to Tell You, a black ski mask, and photos with Johnny Cochran after their 1995 trial. Yep, that's right. Cecil hit pay dirt with what he calls the OJ unit. It belonged to Mike Gilbert. He used to be OJ's agent.
It was a fair and square sale. He didn't pay. They sold the stuff. I luckily was there that day, and I bid $125, and I got the unit.
Cecil more than made his money back. Let's just say he made bank on eBay. The money is nice, but these days bidding on storage units is really more of a hobby. When he first started, though, it was about survival.
When I first got the idea about this thing was, you know, I was homeless. It was me and she was my girlfriend back then. You know, we're married now. And I had a little baby girl, newborn baby. So we were at a motel, and I noticed there was up the street there was some cars and, you know, commotion. So I walked over there, and it was a storage auction.
Cecil's doing well these days. He and his wife both have full-time work. It's not like he needs this. But I don't think he could imagine his life without other people's junk. Now for him, it's less about the loot and more about the story behind it. And ultimately, this is what keeps me in Cecil's garage all afternoon.
That feature was produced by Mwende Hasey with help from Tamara Keith. That piece came from the podcast B-Side Radio. You can find them online at bsideradio.org. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Many of us watched the just-completed Olympic Games in Vancouver. There were amazing sights and thrilling stories, but maybe none that can match the strange story of the marathon run at the 1904 Games in St. Louis. Independent producer Nate DeMeo has more.
Frank Hicks pinned the number 20 to his shirt. He had run far before. Not a marathon, but he had run far and fast. And when he found out that the 1904 Olympics were going to be held in the States for the first time, he started training, doing 10 and 15 mile days on the new paved roads in the outskirts of Boston. He knew he didn't have a shot at winning, but just to be there, running against the best in the world, would be great. The first two Olympics had been awesome. Revived the spirits of the ancient Greeks in Athens in 1896, then Paris in 1900, and now St. Louis, which admittedly wasn't Athens or Paris, but it had somehow managed to land the World's Fair, and then Teddy Roosevelt twisted arms and brought the games to the fair too. It was going to be awesome, Frank Hicks would think while ticking off miles in Massachusetts. He'd never win the thing, but still. As Hicks secured his number and lined up at the starting line at the third Olympic marathon, he realized he may have been wrong. Maybe he could win it. He'd never run this far before, but he'd been training hard. And it was hot, it was 90 in the shade, but he was tough. And looking around, the competition kind of wasn't. There was that Frenchman who lived in Chicago, he was good. And that guy Fred Lors from New York, that guy was the real deal. But that was kind of it. None of the big guns from Europe were there, because who the hell wanted to go to St. Louis? You are Great Britain's greatest Greco-Roman wrestler. You throw the meanest shot put in all of Sweden. You'll go to Athens. You'll book a ticket to Paris. But cross an ocean to the United States and then hop a train to the middle of nowhere, to some city that you probably never even heard of. You'll pass, thanks. So when the marathoners lined up and waited for the starter's pistol, Frank Hicks liked his odds. There were 30 other runners. It looked like there were going to be a lot fewer up until the day before, but then 10 Greeks showed up on the evening train, but they were in terrible shape after their journey. And then there was this little Cuban postman in street shoes who cut his wool work pants off at the knees when he saw everyone else was wearing shorts. And then there were two Africans. The Olympic organizers were frustrated by the lack of international participation, so they wandered over to the World's Fair, which was going on right there at the same time. They walked over to this human zoo, where native peoples from Borneo and Mexico, Central Asia, had been brought to live in reconstructed villages to pretend to go about their daily business for the amusement and supposed education of the ticket-holding Midwesterners. So the organizers walked around asking if anyone wanted to join the race, to give running more than 20 miles a go. Two Zulus did. They were there on display as savage warriors, though they were actually both college students. And they figured, why not? It beat sitting around whittling spears all day while tourists ate cotton candy and laughed at them. So against this competition, Frank Hicks liked his chances. And the gun went off, and the first few miles fell away. And the pack, such as it was, made its way up the first hill. And things went downhill from there. The conditions could not have been worse. All along the route, they shared the road with cars and horses that kicked up dust that choked them and made it hard for them to see. But Hicks was managing to make good time. And one by one, his competition started dropping off. They were felled by cramps and just beaten down by dust and heat. Both of the Zulus were actually hanging right there with him up in the front. But they got chased off course by a pack of dogs. That Cuban postman was running well too. But he got hungry and he took off into an apple orchard for a snack and ended up falling asleep. And Fred Lors, Hicks' big competition, that guy had full-on collapsed at mile 9. So, slow and steady, Hicks could do this. After a few more miles, he knew that he couldn't. The dust was everywhere, in his nostrils, caked on his tongue, sweat dredged channels through it on his forehead, stinging his eyes. Halfway through the race, Hicks was done. He begged out. He begged his coaches, who were driving in a car in front of him kicking dust into his face, begged him for water, and they refused to give it to him. They had some theories they wanted to try out. Instead of giving him a glass of water, they cleaned his mouth out with a dry sponge, and they urged him on. He was in the lead, just 10 miles to go. 9, 8 now. With 7 more, Hicks was staggering. His coaches decided that the dry sponge wasn't going to work anymore, and they brought out the big guns. They figured he'd needed a stimulant to keep him on his feet. They had some brandy, but they thought that might be too dangerous at this stage. They wanted to keep it in reserve in case they needed it at the end for a final kick. So instead of giving him the water that he'd been begging for miles now, they gave him a glass filled with a raw egg and a little bit of rat poison. And Hicks kept racing, in that he kept moving forward, though his coaches had to walk next to him to keep him from tipping over. And he started hallucinating from the dehydration and the heat and fatigue and rat poison. With 4 miles left, he tried to lie down in the middle of the road and fall asleep. But his coaches were undeterred. Their man was up in the pack by a mile and a quarter. Victory, if not a cup of water, was in his grasp. They pulled out all the stops. They busted out the brandy. Frank Hicks would win this race if they had to carry him across the finish line. Which they did. Three men entered the Olympic Stadium. Hicks, gray and tripping on rat poison, raw eggs, and French brandy, and his two coaches holding up either shoulder, one man keeping them going straight, the other working Hicks's legs like a puppet. And when they crossed the finish line, and Hicks was finally allowed to collapse, and the coaches slapped each other on the back for their man's victory and their own ingenious interventions, they looked up to realize that Fred Lors, the fast New Yorker who had dropped out 9 miles into the race, had actually won the race. It wasn't until later that they found out that after collapsing, Lors had hopped into a car that dropped him off a block away from the stadium, and he waited till a believable amount of time had passed and jogged in and got a standing ovation. Hicks at least got a glass of water.
That was independent producer Nate DeMeo. You can hear his podcast, The Memory Palace, at www.thememorypalace.us. You're listening to Sidetrack. A is a 17-year-old who attends City High School in Tucson, Arizona, and she doesn't care if you think it's strange that she finds life easier in the company of her purple stuffed rabbit, Grape Jelly. Here she is to tell you more.
I don't know where he came from. He may have come from the tiled halls of a grocery store, sandwiched between the greeting cards and roses, or he may have come from a kindergarten birthday party in a big field under a cool December sky. I don't know where he came from, and it doesn't matter, because he's here now. His fur was once bright purple and soft, his tail pure white and cottony. I can't remember him like that, though. I can only picture him as he is now, purple-gray and matted, with his awkward plastic whiskers jutting in opposite directions, his floppy purple ears, and his black, angular smile that is so charmingly uneven. He seems to have the ability to absorb every soothing, sweet smell that I can think of. Sometimes he smells like incense, and sometimes he smells like rose perfume. Sometimes he smells like my warm bed and blankets, and other times he smells like the comforting dust of my home. His name is Grape Jelly, and he's an off-brand Beanie Baby rabbit. Grape Jelly never gives me advice, and he never tells me to suck it up. He never gets angry or raises his voice at me. Grape Jelly has never ditched me, blown me off, talked badly about me, or hurt my feelings. He lets me cry on his shoulder, and that's saying a lot, because my snot and tears soak into him and stay there. Now that's a friend. I'm 17 years old, and I still carry this purple rabbit with me to school every day. I don't think most people realize why he's so important to me. Why do you think I bring Grape Jelly to school?
Possibly because school can get lonely sometimes, and you need a little friend.
Because he's cute, and you want something cute on your desk. I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I've just seen, like, A, Grape Jelly, and there's no reason, it just is.
Because it's like a security blanket, kind of.
Well, he's your little buddy and you've had him forever, and maybe one day you thought, hey, I'll just bring my little Grape Jelly to school.
I'm a big fan of Grape Jelly, the little rabbit.
And like Vaughn said, you know, it could be a security blanket thing. It could also just be, you know, a way to focus on something happy when there's chaos going on around you.
I don't really know. I don't think I've ever really wondered why. Just that you do it.
The truth is that he's my best friend. He's like another appendage. I feel as though Grape Jelly is not just a toy or an object. He's real and he cares about me. Maybe it's a little immature and materialistic and probably even a little crazy. But I do care about him because he keeps me safe. Grape Jelly has helped me make friends. He's helped me think. I chew on his whiskers. And he's calmed me down a countless number of occasions. I remember during my junior year, my sister always made us late, but one morning it was later than usual. My father laid on the horn, and after a minute or so, my sister Grace came storming out the door. She got in the car and began screaming at my dad. They fought loudly while I sat in silence in the back seat. I squeezed Grape Jelly in my hands, my eyes shut tightly in a vain attempt to keep from crying. When I finally got to school, I ran down the stairs, almost blinded from my hot tears. I hid in an empty room and sobbed. I held my rabbit close, drying my eyes on his back and trying to catch my breath. I swear I knew what he was saying when I looked at him. "You're okay," he said. "Everything is fine." And he was right. I stood up and I went to class. Over the years, I've grown very attached to him. He's more than just a prop, or a distraction, or a joke. Without him around, I feel lost. If I misplace him or forget him at home, I get the most gut-wrenching, scum-of-the-earth kind of feeling in my stomach. Especially when I can't find him. I start thinking of all the most awful situations. What if someone stole him? What if he was thrown away? What if someone took him home and I'll never see him again? Once, when I was feeling really hopeless, I thought of making flyers with my phone number and a reward offered. I think part of me wants to grow up and be mature and face the scary, dirty, evil world. And the other part of me is terrified. I cling to Grape Jelly so he can protect me and keep me innocent. Without him, I feel like a sinner, like a bad, awful person. That's why I get so upset when I misplace him. It's why I cry into him, and why he's so comforting. Because without him, I'm forced to grow up.
That was A, an 11th grader at City High School in Tucson, Arizona, where she is a member of the City High Radio Program, which was founded and is taught by Sarah Bromer. An additional credit here, our teenage producer, A, also wrote and recorded all the ukulele music used in this piece. Still to come, radio plays from Chatterbox Audio Theater and 19th century newspaper personal ads. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. It's always been tough to meet people. It used to be even tougher, as independent producer Emma Jacobs found out when she talked with a woman who's been reading the personals from the 19th century.
Pam Epstein was a graduate student looking for a topic for her doctoral research when a friend mentioned the classifieds. She had just seen a pair of skis offered in exchange for an engagement ring.
These become stories.
Pam was curious, and she started reading older classified ads from the 19th century. Before long, she found the personal ads.
Sometimes you'd have a lot of matrimonials all on one page, and they all do come up together. But they are, I mean, they're surrounded by other ads for clairvoyance or ads for prosthetic feet, you know, right next to an ad for someone who wants to get married.
A lot changed in the 19th century.
Yeah.
People were moving to cities and starting new jobs. Pretty soon, Epstein saw all this in the personal ads when she found one advertisement from 1864.
Where this young guy goes on and on and on about how he just wants to meet the love of his life and he can't. A young gentleman in all respects favorably situated in life, as life is commonly estimated, but still wanting the essential element of happiness, of prepossessing appearance and manners, elevated aims, best, and no he trusts no ordinary capabilities and attainments.
And action, enlarged, liberal, and charitable in views, to whom all modes, if honorable, are alike, so they achieve the desired end, despising the narrow bigotry and conventionalities of society, which, by interposing barriers to the free intercourse of the sexes, and thus limiting our choices, can condemn multitudes of even the most favored to lives of celibacy and misery. Regarding the world as his matrimonial field, and believing that it contains somewhere the congenial spirit, the bright particular
star, which comes from Shakespeare,
the light of whose blessed presence and sweet influence his social confines, extensive as contracted souls would consider them, have shut him out from, adopts this method as the only one open to him of testing the reality of his faith and hopes.
And that's actually one sentence right there.
He makes worldly advantages beyond unquestionable respectability.
And that's where he's talking about, you know, social segregation, keeps people apart, makes marriages difficult for love because you're limited to who you know. There was an assumption previously that of course you'd be able to meet someone because everybody knew everybody. When you get to bigger cities where not everybody knows everybody and you have to be introduced, it starts being a bigger and bigger problem.
People were having trouble finding each other.
But none who, to an agreeable person, expressive face.
And then again,
engaging.
This is how he solves it.
Full letters, including description, personal, and mental, solicited as indicative of character and capacity. Address Bertram. June 4th.
That's all's well that ends well.
Pam Epstein has now read hundreds of these ads. She publishes her favorites on a blog. And she says these relationships are still in the margins. Not really relationships that were supposed to happen. Some of the most obvious examples are the people who began to show up more than once, writing back and forth in the paper. They would use initials or nicknames.
Othello and Desdemona, Romeo and Juliet. This particular couple who ended up writing 10, 12, 15 ads from hair dye to eyebrows.
That's using hair dye and
communicate.
Eyebrows.
These come from April of 1885 and then go through June. The first one that I ever found says eyebrows.
Eyebrows. Had you trusted me and been more frank with me in the past week, nothing disagreeable would have happened. Have no fear for the future. I shall not try any more. Whether I hear from you again or not will be for you to decide. Hair dye.
And then a bunch of them are just trying to make arrangements.
Any day before
can
four.
You meet me on this
Let
day?
Let me know if possible when you are coming. Hair dye.
And then you start seeing hair dye getting more and more
eyebrows.
Heartbroken.
Disappointed yesterday. Can meet you anywhere today before 2 o'clock. If you can arrange matters, telegraph or send note to office before 1 o'clock. Hair dye. Eyebrows, still without reply. I trust you have not become utterly indifferent. Remember that where there is a will, there is also a way. Let me hear from you today. Hair dye.
They go on like that, and actually they get more and more depressing, and hair dye seems to be increasingly desperate, and eyebrows seems to be increasingly indifferent, until it finally ends the last ad I found.
Eyebrows, do not bear malice when no offense was intended. I hope to hear from you Monday. Hair dye.
Which is not a happy ending.
But you think that she must, I mean, it looks like from the number of these that she was getting some response in between.
My decision in the blog was that hair dye was probably a single working girl. I think maybe she had a job in the mornings. While eyebrows was perhaps a married man. And so he could write her letters directly to wherever she lived. But she obviously couldn't do that because he might have a wife. And so she has to put her ads in the paper, and then he can respond in any way he chooses. Now, again, you know, when I say things like this, I could be right. I could be totally wrong, and it could be something else entirely. There's so many questions that are so hard to answer.
Because it's not like you're going to be able to find these people again.
No, I don't know who these people are. I will never know who these people are. I can't make any assumptions about them, really. They're so open to interpretation, which is what makes them really interesting.
Pam's not the first to guess at the stories behind these ads. These were entertainment at the time.
Ads in the paper.
And a lot of writers looked into them, too.
I wonder, do people respond to them, and I wonder who they are.
But these 19th century reporters have information she never will. Because sometimes, after they published their articles, the people in the personals wrote back.
Just what he feels. Keeps a letter in the pocket of his coat. But but he never breaks a seal.
That feature from independent producer Emma Jacobs. You can read more of Pam Epstein's personal collection at advertisingforlove.com. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. When director Kenny Leon first considered Thornton Wilder's play Our Town for his True Colors Theater Company in Atlanta, Georgia, he knew he had a problem. The play is an American theater classic, but its setting and time frame make it feel a bit dated. How could Leon make the play relevant for Atlanta's modern urban audience? Independent producer Philip Greitzer has the story.
Thornton Wilder's 1938 Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Our Town, is the most produced play in America. Set at the turn of the century in the fictional town of Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, it's a place where everyone knows everyone else, and life is, well, ordinary. Actors play townspeople as they go about their daily lives. They work, they go to church, they gossip, and they flirt.
Well, I feel it's the other way around. That men aren't naturally good, but girls are.
Oh, you might as well know right now that I am not perfect, George. It's not as easy for a girl to be perfect as a man.
Sounds like a typical girl-boy kind of chat, doesn't it? But in the True Colors Theater Company production, Emily Webb, daughter of the town's newspaper editor, is white. Her boyfriend and future husband, George Gibbs, the doctor's son, is black.
Integrated racially many of the families in the play, and I listened to those stories, and for the first time I felt like Our Town spoke to me.
Director Kenny Leon decided to integrate the cast after a workshop reading of the play. When he did that, he suddenly saw Our Town's deeper meaning.
The play is not a racial play. It's a human play that reminds us that, you know, life is fleeting, and how do we spend our time on the planet? You know, do we really give our kids quality time, and do we really spend time the way we should?
Leon figured if he recreated this multiracial Grover's Corners on stage, it would resonate with broader audiences too.
I wanted it to be more universal. I want everyone to feel included. I specifically wanted one family to be black, one family to be white. Their children would marry each other. I wanted black folks there to feel they were included. I wanted white folks to feel they were included. And I wanted there to be an interracial marriage.
The actors are in modern dress, but the production sticks with Wilder's original dialogue. No mention is made of race or the interracial marriage in this idyllic town. Donna Bisco, an actor who plays Mrs. Gibbs, is black. Her son George marries Emily. She thinks this fictional Grover's Corners is a hopeful image.
It's about living together in harmony as one. It gives you a sense of how things should be, or how a lot of us hope that it could be.
The Grover's Corners of Thornton Wilder never existed. It was Wilder's vision of what could have been. Kenny Leon's Grover's Corners is idealized, too. A snapshot of what life in America might become. But that dream may have already been realized. Actor Mark Kincaid is white. He plays Emily's father.
What the play looks like, it looks like America. This is what America looks like. These black families and white families have the same experiences, the same life choices, the same decisions, the same conflicts. All it does is it just says, this is who we really are.
And in a world free of racial stereotypes, director Kenny Leon thinks a colorblind Our Town will speak to everyone.
It's a play that reminds us, hey, slow down, smell the flowers, kiss your kids, you know, love your family. Get rid of those stupid things that separate us and divide us as people.
I'm Philip Greitzer.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sidetrack.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. What lovely dancing. And next we shall have a waltz. Pair up, please. Pair up.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Margaret, wait. I'm very sorry. Please pardon me.
Well, Mr. Conroy, if you haven't any other partner at the moment, I hope you wouldn't object to dancing with me.
Why, of course not, Miss Ivers. I would be delighted.
Good. I have a bone to pick with you.
Is everybody ready?
Yes.
One, two, three, here we go.
Moving a James Joyce story from Dublin to Memphis is no small task. But a group of actors and computer-savvy people from Tennessee are up to the challenge. And they are acting out plays and short skits for online listeners. Dead and Gone is a U.S. retelling of Joyce's short story, The Dead, in which a school teacher in the early 1900s struggles with the social scene at his aunt's holiday party.
I have discovered that you write for the New Scimitar, Mr. Conroy. Now, aren't you ashamed of yourself?
And why should I be ashamed of myself?
Well, I'm ashamed of you. To think you'd write for a progressivist rag like that. I hadn't pegged you for a scallywag, Mr. Conroy. You, who are in charge of so many young minds.
Miss Ivers, it is true that I write a literary column every Wednesday for the New Scimitar, but it only concerns literature and has nothing whatever to do with politics. Surely that alone does not make me a scallywag. Surely that...
Of course, Mr. Conroy. I was only joking with you. Oh, come, we turn now.
Dead and Gone is among more than 30 shows performed by the Memphis-based Chatterbox Audio Theater. Jeff Bosser talked with the group's executive director, Bob Arnold, about launching the group 3 years ago.
Really, Chatterbox was just this sort of confluence of different interests that I have. I have been involved in theater a long time, although never as much in the technical side of theater. I like the acting, you know, I like the script writing and things like that. And then I actually happened to have several friends at the time who were interested in these different elements. A guy who was very interested in recording technology, sound engineering. Another guy who was doing website work, and another friend who was very into the theater scene and doing a whole lot of interesting work with that. And somehow I was out with one of these guys one night, and this topic of radio theater came up, and came up very casually, you know, just something we were sort of batting around. I think with that group of creative people, we always bat around a bunch of ideas, and this was one of them, but something about it stuck with me. And knowing that I had those four friends with those four interests, I sort of started realizing I could bring them all together and we could create something really different than what was going on around here or anything that we knew about was going on.
So did this originally plan to be something solely online, or were you able to find maybe some times to actually perform before an audience?
I always pictured it being online. I think the other thing that really contributed to the start of Chatterbox was the fact that right now is a great time for things like podcasting. It's a great time for home recording. 15, 20 years ago, consumer-grade equipment couldn't get you the kind of quality that it does now. And also, there wasn't this ready distribution point that there is with iTunes and the internet and everybody's podcasting. So if you look out there, you look at podcasting, you'll find that the vast majority of it is still, even now, you know, years after it was launched, is just a couple people sitting around a microphone just sort of chatting. And I think part of what I was thinking about at the beginning of Chatterbox was, wow, wouldn't it be neat to raise that bar, to really bring some production values into podcasting in a way that, of course, had been done during the golden age of radio back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So it was always something that I envisioned being online because I like that idea of universal access, of simple worldwide distribution, so that literally the stuff that we were working on here in Memphis could be heard anywhere around the world.
And how'd you get the word out and recruit actors and pull them away from their busy, you know, schedule of performing on stage?
Well, that's something we're still working to do. But initially, I was in a production that one of my friends, Kyle Hatley, who is still our artistic director, he was directing a production of Romeo and Juliet here in town and cast me in it. And that was sort of my jump back into the world of theater and especially into the world of Memphis community theater. So I made a lot of connections then, met a lot of people. So as we were working on that play, I was developing scripts and ideas for Chatterbox. But the truth is, actors, and especially community theater actors around here, are such a giving and excited group of people that when you go to them and say, look, we're doing this thing, it's different than what you're used to doing. It has the potential to be heard around the world. I only need you for a week or two. Most of them absolutely jump at the chance to be involved.
I would assume some of the appeal is I could play four characters, but I don't have to wear costumes associated with them. And I don't have to memorize several pages of script.
That's absolutely true. In a lot of ways, the pressure comes off because, you know, we have done some live shows, but most of our shows are done kind of in the studio where if you flub a line, you know, we're going to go back and cut that out. Any mistake that you make is not going to be sealed in concrete and there forever. So, yeah, there is no line memorization, you know, there's no blocking. Well, that's actually not true. There is blocking. The way that we do our shows ends up being very kinetic, and there are a lot of, you know, actors need to be at certain points at certain times, but there's not a lot of real heavy, stagey kind of work that goes into it, and I think that frees people up to do things like create different voices and really get imaginative with their performances.
How far out there have you heard from? You get people, say somebody overseas who has listened to a show, or what's the maybe the wildest, most far-reaching response you've gotten to one of the shows?
Well, it's funny that you ask. I actually got an email from a guy in Nepal saying he was interested in audio theater and had heard our stuff and was asking me how to get into it and how to get started with it. So we've heard, it's mostly, of course, English-speaking countries, but we heard from a girl in Romania who was using Chatterbox shows to learn English. We've heard from school teachers nationally across the country saying that they're using Chatterbox in their classrooms when they read a story like The Yellow Wallpaper or Kafka's In the Penal Colony. They will supplement it by listening to a Chatterbox show in their classroom.
How did people find out about it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's kind of hard to know. That's part of the fascinating thing about the Internet. You start putting stuff out there, and somehow people start finding it. We have done a lot of work, sort of word-of-mouth work, on our end, and our managing director, Dave Mickle, who is my web guy, who does everything with the website, has done a great job getting us high rankings in Google and things like that. But the truth is, people will go online and they will type out Yellow Wallpaper, and at some point in their search results, our show comes up, and people find that and they latch onto it. We've also been picked up by some other websites, things like webenglishteacher.com, which is sort of a conglomeration of teacher resources. So they'll post, hey, look, this group has got this adaptation of this show that you know, you may be reading Rip Van Winkle and you may want to hear their show, and people find us that way. So it seems to be the trend that people find us because of our adaptations, and my hope is that then they stick around, of course, to check out stuff that they may not have heard of, our original stuff or some of the more obscure stuff that we have put together.
Your web content, putting it up there, and just the audio production, are they expensive to put on, or how, I guess more specifically, how do you pay for them?
Well, right now, Chatterbox is purely a labor of love in all quadrants. Nobody gets paid to do it. I don't get paid to do it. None of the actors, writers, musicians, artists, nobody gets paid to do it yet. So the great thing, though, about podcasting is once you have kind of a base of equipment, the sky's the limit. You know, you're not talking about doing huge sound effects or huge special effects sequences like you might in a film or something like that. You're not talking about doing location shooting. You know, give us a microphone and a mixer and some sound effects stuff, and we can do damn near anything. That's one of the really powerful things about audio theater, is that the vast majority of it is powered by the listener's imagination. So all we have got to be able to do is be able to suggest something that's going on, and the imagination fills in the rest of it. So in answer to your question, it doesn't cost a heck of a lot. We've got a few friends and supporters who have donated some kind of operating funds to us for web hosting and costs like that. But we're also, at this point, still using a lot of our own, just our personal equipment. And, you know, if it turns out, hey, we need $5 worth of dry ice to do this effect, then I just go to the store and buy it.
You talked about being able to go back and edit something if somebody flubs the line, but you have done live performances. I'm specifically talking about WKNO, the NPR affiliate in Memphis. And was the Halloween show the first one?
Yeah, the 2008 Halloween show was okay. The first. That was the first on-air show. Now, we've also done live in theater shows, so it's a different setup, but still a live performance that we've recorded for the website.
What was the first one you had in front of an audience?
I think that would be our Sight Gag show, which is our sketch comedy troupe. We have, I think, two episodes posted right now of original sketch comedy, which was something that was pretty obviously not going to work without an audience there to liven things up. You know, we wanted to hear the laughter and the responses and all that. So we borrowed space at a great little community theater here in the area and had a live audience and did a sketch comedy show, which I think was a good one to start with because even the flubs there are pretty funny.
We now take you to zombie speed dating.
Yes!
So, what are your interests?
Brains.
I'm so tired of people only being interested in me for my body. I just want someone who loves me for my...
brains.
Exactly!
The rain in Spain falls mainly on the...
brains.
Incorrect.
Hi. I really hate these things, but my friend dragged me along. You want to go out and grab some...
frozen yogurt.
Great! Let's try 31 flavors. I hear they have great toppings. Sprinkles, nuts, cherries...
brains.
Whatever floats your boat.
I guess the step up, the next big challenge for yourselves was something like a Halloween show where you had to work in a lot of sound effects.
That's right. So from the live stage shows, of course, we started thinking, wouldn't it be cool to do live shows on the radio? Again, just like they did all through the golden age of radio. You know, the vast majority of that stuff, especially early on, was all performed live. And sometimes every now and then you'll come across an actor messing up or you'll come across somebody breaking up laughing or something like that. So there is that element of, you know, I guess pressure might be the right word, but it's excitement. It's an exciting kind of pressure. It's a challenge. Even more so, I think, than a stage show where you're performing for a limited house of people. These live on-air radio shows that we're also recording for the website, yeah, there's the pressure of performing it for the radio audience and the website audience. But I think the worst thing to do is to think about that too much before you go on the air. So this is the second year that we did a two-hour live show on WKNO here in Memphis, and it's a little horror anthology show. So it's seven short horror stories that run the gamut from these sort of dark, creeping, brooding stories to just absolute, over-the-top, almost campy, crazy, freaky monster stories.
Morgan, who had stopped and was intently watching the agitated chaparral, said nothing but cocked both barrels of his gun and held it ready. I thought him a trifle excited, which surprised me, for he had a reputation for exceptional coolness, even in moments of peril.
There are sounds we cannot hear. At either end of the scale are notes that stir no chord of that imperfect instrument, the human ear. They are too high or too grave.
What are you doing, Morgan? You're not going to fill up a deer with quail shot, are you?
I have observed a flock of blackbirds occupying an entire treetop, the tops of several trees, and all in full song. Suddenly, in a moment, at absolutely the same instant, all spring into the air and fly away.
Morgan did not reply, but catching sight of his face as he turned it slightly toward me, I was struck by the intensity of his look.
How? They could not all see one another. Whole treetops intervened. At no point could a leader have been visible to all.
It was then that I understood we had serious business at hand, and my first conjecture was that we had jumped a grizzly. I advanced to Morgan's side, cocking my gun as I moved.
There must have been a signal of warning or command high and shrill above the din, but by me unheard.
The bushes were quiet, and the sounds had ceased, but Morgan was as attentive to the place as before. Morgan!
As with sounds, so with colors. The human eye is an imperfect instrument. Its range is but a few octaves of the real chromatic scale.
Morgan, what is it? Come on, man! What the devil is out there?
The damned thing.
I was about to speak further, when I observed the wild oats near the place of the disturbance moving in the most inexplicable way. I can hardly describe it. It seemed as if stirred by a streak of wind, which not only bent it, but pressed it down, crushed it so that it did not rise. And this movement was prolonging itself directly towards us.
I am not mad. There are colors that we cannot see.
Morgan, what are you doing? What are you doing, man? There's nothing there.
And God help me. The damned thing is of such a color.
Morgan, what in God's
name? Run, you fool, run!
Parker! Parker!
I guess the one thing missing from radio theater and for people like yourself and a lot of your people who I assume are regular performers, unless you're in front of the audience on a few occasions, is that standing ovation and how you are rewarded or how you feel justified in having done a good job afterwards.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. It's a different kind of experience than a stage production because you don't have that immediate payoff. You don't have that immediate audience reaction. And a lot of times we will record, on recording night, we always record the show through twice, at least twice, to make sure we have a good take. And after that's over, you know, every now and then a stage actor will say, that's it, you know, that's kind of all. So we always, you know, we make an effort to have a cast party after every show. And then when I can, I get the actors back together to listen to the final product, and that's when the payoff hits. When they, you know, work on this thing for a couple of weeks and then take a couple of weeks off while we do the, you know, whatever cleanup we have to do, and then when they get back together and hear this thing anew from kind of from the other side of it, that's when a lot of them go, whoa, wow, okay, I really get it. You know, that really turned into something great.
That was Bob Arnold, the executive director of Chatterbox Audio Theater, based in Memphis, Tennessee. He spoke with Jeff Bossert. Upcoming shows include an adaptation of Robert Louis Stevenson's short story, Markheim. Chatterbox actors also hope to create online adaptations of Pinocchio and Moby Dick. A full library of dramas, sketch comedy, and children's shows from the online group of actors is available for streaming, MP3 download, and through iTunes at chatterboxtheater.org. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.